This is Audible.
The Borrowers by Mary Norton. Read by Samantha Bond. It was Mrs. May who first told me about them. No, not me. How could it have been me? A wild, untidy, self-willed little girl who stared with angry eyes and was said to crunch her teeth. Kate, she should have been called. Yes, that was it. Kate. Not that the name matters much either way. She barely comes into the story. Mrs. May lived in two rooms in Kate's parents' house in London. Her bedroom was on the first floor, and her sitting room was a room which, as part of the house, was called the breakfast room. Now, breakfast rooms are all right in the morning when the sun streams in on the toast and marmalade. But by afternoon, they seem to vanish a little and to fill with a strange silvery light, their own twilight. There's a kind of sadness in them then, but as a child, it was a sadness Kate liked. She would creep into Mrs. May just before tea time, and Mrs. May would teach her to crochet. Mrs. May was old. Her joints were stiff, and she was not strict exactly, but she had that inner certainty which does instead. Kate was never wild with Mrs. May, nor untidy, nor self-willed. And Mrs. May taught her many things beside crochet, how to wind wool into an egg-shaped ball, how to tidy a drawer, and to lay like a blessing above the contents a sheet of rustling tissue against the dust. "Why so quiet, child?" asked Mrs. May one day, when Kate was sitting hunched and idle upon the hassock. "What's the matter with you? Have you lost your tongue?" "No," said Kate, pulling at her shoe button. "I've lost the crochet hook. They were making a bed quilt in woolen squares. There were 30 still to do. I know where I put it," she went on hastily. "I put it on the bottom shelf of the bookcase just beside my bed." "On the bottom shelf," repeated Mrs. May, her own needle flicking steadily in the firelight. "Near the floor?" "Yes," said Kate. "But I looked on the floor, under the rug, everywhere. The wool was still there, though, just where I'd left it."
"Oh, dear," exclaimed Mrs. May lightly. "Don't say they're in this house, too."
"But what are?" asked Kate.
"The Borrowers," said Mrs. May, and in the half-light she seemed to smile.
Kate stared a little fearfully. "Are there such things?" she asked after a moment.
"As what?"
Kate blinked. "As people, other people living in a house who borrow things." Mrs. May laid down her work.
"What do you think?" she asked.
"I don't know," said Kate, looking away and pulling hard at her shoe button. "There can't be. And yet..." she raised her head. "And yet sometimes I think there must be."
"Why do you think there must be?" asked Mrs. May.
"Because of all the things that disappear. Safety pins, for instance. Factories go on making safety pins, and everyday people go on buying safety pins, and yet somehow there never is a safety pin just when you want one. Where are they all? Now, at this minute, where do they all go to? And take needles," she went on. "All the needles my mother ever bought. There must be hundreds. Can't just be lying about this house."
"Not lying about the house, no," agreed Mrs. May.
"And all the other things we keep on buying, again and again and again, like pencils and matchboxes and hair slides and drawing pins."
"And hat pins," put in Mrs. May, "and blotting paper."
"Yes, blotting paper," agreed Kate, "but not hat pins."
"That's where you're wrong," said Mrs. May, and she picked up her work again. "There was a reason for hat pins."
Kate stared. "A reason? What kind of reason?"
"Well, there were two reasons, really. A hat pin is a very useful weapon, and..."
Mrs. May laughed suddenly.
"But it all sounds such nonsense, and..."
she hesitated.
"It was so very long ago."
"But tell me," said Kate. "Tell me how you know about the hat pin. Did you ever see one?"
Mrs. May threw her a startled glance. "Well, yes," she began. "Not a hatpin," exclaimed Kate impatiently. "A whatever you call them. A borrower." Mrs. May drew a sharp breath. "No," she said quickly. "I never saw one."
"But someone else saw one," cried Kate. "And you know about it. I can see you do."
"Hush," said Mrs. May. "No need to shout." She gazed downwards at the upturned face, and then she smiled, and her eyes slid away into distance. "I had a brother," she began uncertainly. Kate knelt upon the hassock.
"And he saw them?"
"I don't know," said Mrs. May, shaking her head. "I just don't know." She smoothed out her work upon her knee. "He was such a tease. He told us so many things, my sister and me. Impossible things." "He was killed," she added gently, "many years ago now, on the northwest frontier. He became colonel of his regiment. He died what they call a hero's death."
"Was he your only brother?"
"Yes. And he was our little brother."
"I think that was why," she thought for a moment, still smiling to herself. "Yes, why he told us such impossible stories, such strange imaginings.
He was jealous, I think, because we were older, and because we could read better. He wanted to impress us. He wanted, perhaps, to shock us. And yet," she looked into the fire, "there was something about him. Perhaps because we were brought up in India among mystery and magic and legend, something that made us think he saw things that other people could not see." She leaned forward, and in her tidy way, brushed a fan of loose ashes under the grate. Then, brush in hand, she stared again at the fire. "He wasn't a very strong little boy. The first time he came home from India, he got rheumatic fever. He missed a whole term at school and was sent away to the country to get over it, to the house of a great aunt. Later I went there myself. It was a strange old house."
She hung up the brush on its brass hook, and dusting her hands on her handkerchief, she picked up her work.
"Better light the lamp," she said.
"Not yet," begged Kate, leaning forward. "Please go on. Please tell me."
"But I've told you."
"No, you haven't. This old house, wasn't that where he saw...
Mrs. May laughed. "Where he saw the borrowers. Yes, that's what he told us. What he'd have us believe. And what's more, it seems that he didn't just see them, but that he got to know them very well. That he became part of their lives, as it were. In fact, you might almost say that he became a borrower himself."
"Oh, do tell me. Please, try to remember right from the beginning."
"But I do remember," said Mrs. May. "Oddly enough, I remember it better than many real things which have happened. Perhaps it was a real thing. I just don't know. You see, on the way back to India, my brother and I had to share a cabin. And on those very hot nights, often we couldn't sleep. My brother would talk for hours and hours, repeating conversations, telling me details again and again, wondering how they were and what they were doing, and..."
"They? Who are they, exactly?"
"Homily, Pod, and little Arietti."
"Pod?"
"Yes. Even their names were never quite right. They imagined they had their own names, quite different from human names, but with half an ear you could tell they were borrowed. Even Uncle Hendreary's and Eglantina's. Everything they had was borrowed. They had nothing of their own at all, nothing. In spite of this, my brother said, they were touchy and conceited and thought they owned the world."
"How do you mean?"
"They thought human beings were just invented to do the dirty work, great slaves put there for them to use. But my brother said that underneath, he thought they were frightened. It was because they were frightened he thought that they had grown so small. Each generation had become smaller and smaller and more hidden. In the olden days, it seems, and in some parts of England, our ancestors talked quite openly about the little people."
"Yes," said Kate.
I know. Nowadays, I suppose, Mrs. May went on slowly, if they exist at all, you would only find them in houses which are old and quiet and deep in the country, and where human beings live to a routine. Routine is their safeguard. It is important for them to know which rooms are to be used and when. They do not stay long where there are careless people, unruly children, or certain household pets. This particular old house, of course, was ideal. Great Aunt Sophie was bedridden through a hunting accident some 20 years before, and as for human beings, there was only Mrs. Driver the cook, Crampfell the gardener, and at rare intervals an odd housemaid or such. My brother, too, when he was there after rheumatic fever, had to spend long hours in bed, and for those first weeks, it seems, the borrowers did not know of his existence. He slept in the old night nursery beyond the schoolroom. The schoolroom was sheeted and shrouded and filled with junk. Odd trunks, a broken sewing machine, a desk, a dressmaker's dummy, and a disused pianola, as Great-Aunt Sophie's children had long since grown up. The night nursery opened out of the schoolroom, and from his bed, my brother could see the oil painting of the Battle of Waterloo which hung above the schoolroom fireplace, and on the wall, a corner cupboard with glass doors, in which was set out, on hooks and shelves, a doll's tea service, very delicate and old. At night, if the schoolroom door was open, he had a view down the lighted passage which led to the staircase, and it would comfort him to see, each evening at dusk, Mrs. Driver appear at the head of the stairs, carrying a tray for Aunt Sophie, with Bath Oliver biscuits and the tall cut-glass decanter of fine old pale Madeira. On her way out, Mrs. Driver would pause and lower the gas jet in the passage to a dim blue flame, and then he would watch her as she stumped away downstairs, sinking slowly out of sight between the banisters. Under this passage in the hall below, there was a clock, and through the night he would hear it strike the hours. It was a grandfather clock, and very old. Mr. Frith of Leighton Buzzard came each month to wind it, as his father had come before him, and his great-uncle before that. For 80 years, they said, it had not stopped, and as far as anyone could tell, for as many years before that. The great thing was that it must never be moved. It stood against the wainscot, and the stone flags around it had been washed so often that a little platform, my brother said, rose up inside. And under this clock, below the wainscot, there was a hole. It was Pod's hole, the keep of his fortress, the entrance to his home. Not that his home was anywhere near the clock, far from it. There were yards of dark and dusty passageways, with wooden doors between the joists and metal gates against the mice. Pod used all kinds of things for these gates, a flat leaf of a folding cheese grater, the hinged lid of a small cash box, a wire fly swatter. "Not that I'm afraid of mice," Homily would say, "but I can't abide the smell." In vain, Arietti begged for a little mouse of her own, a little blind mouse to bring up by hand, like Eglantina had had. But Homily would bang with the pan lids and exclaim, "And look what happened to Eglantina!" "What?" Arietti would ask. "What did happen to Eglantina?" But no one would ever say. It was only Pod who knew the way through the intersecting passages to the hole under the clock, and only Pod could open the gates. His wife and child led more sheltered lives under the kitchen, far removed from the risks and dangers of the dreaded house above. But there was a grating in the brick wall of the house, just below the floor level of the kitchen, through which Arietti could see the garden. A piece of gravelled path and a bank where crocus bloomed in spring, where blossom drifted from an unseen tree, and where birds came and pecked and flirted and sometimes fought. "The hours you waste on them birds," Homily would say, "and when there's a little job to be done, you can never find the time. I was brought up in a house where there wasn't no grating, and we were all the happier for it. Now go off and get me the potato." That was the day when Arietti, rolling the potato before her from the storehouse down the dusty lane under the floorboards, kicked it ill-temperedly, so that it rolled rather fast into their kitchen, where Homily was stooping over the stove.
"There you go again," exclaimed Homily. "Nearly pushed me into the soup. And when I say potato, I don't mean the whole potato. Take the scissor, can't you, and cut off a slice."
"Didn't know how much you wanted," Arietti had mumbled, as Homily, snorting and sniffing, unhooked the blade and handle of half a pair of manicure scissors from a nail on the wall and began to cut through the peel.
"You've ruined this potato," she grumbled. "You can't roll it back now in all that dust, not once it's been cut open."
"Oh, what does it matter?" said Arietti. "There are plenty more."
"Plenty more? Do you realize," Homily went on gravely, laying down the half-nail scissor, "that your poor father risks his life every time he borrows a potato?"
"I meant," said Arietti, "that there are plenty more in the storeroom." She had wandered through into the sitting room. The fire had been lighted, and the room looked bright and cozy. The walls had been papered with scraps of old letters out of waste paper baskets, and Homily had arranged the handwriting sideways in vertical stripes that ran from floor to ceiling. On the walls, repeated in various colours, hung several portraits of Queen Victoria as a girl. These were postage stamps, borrowed by Pod some years ago from the stamp box in the morning room. There was a lacquer trinket box, padded inside, and with the lid open, which they used as a settle, and a chest of drawers made of matchboxes. There was a round table with a red velvet cloth, which Pod had made from the wooden bottom of a pillbox supported on the carved pedestal of a knight from the chess set. This had caused a great deal of trouble upstairs, when Aunt Sophie's eldest son had invited the vicar for a game after dinner. Rosa Pick Hatchett, who was housemaid at the time, gave in her notice. Not long after she had left, other things were found to be missing, and from that time onwards, Mrs. Driver ruled supreme. The knight itself, its bust, so to speak, was standing on a column in the corner, where it lent that air to the room which only statuary can give. Beside the fire, in a tilted wooden bookcase, stood Arietti's library. This was a set of those miniature volumes which the Victorians loved to print, but which to Arietti seemed the size of very large church Bibles. There was Bryce's Tom Thumb Gazetteer of the World, Bryce's Tom Thumb Dictionary, Bryce's Tom Thumb Edition of the Comedies of William Shakespeare, another book whose pages were all blank called Memoranda, and last but not least, Arietti's favourite, Bryce's Tom Thumb Diary and Proverb book, with a saying for each day of the year. Arietti had learnt to read from these books, and to write by leaning sideways and copying out the writings on the walls. She did not always keep her diary, although on most days she would take the book out for the sake of the saying which sometimes would comfort her. Today it said, "You may go farther and fare worse," and underneath, "Order of the Garter, instituted 1348. She carried the book to the fire and sat down with her feet on the hob.
"What are you doing, Arietti?" called Homily from the kitchen.
"Writing my diary."
"Oh," exclaimed Homily shortly.
Homily liked her to write. Homily herself, poor ignorant creature, could not even say the alphabet. Arietti took out her pencil. It was a small white pencil with a piece of silk cord attached, which had come off a dance program, but in Arietti's hand it looked like a rolling pin.
"Arietti," called Homily again from the kitchen, "put a little something on the fire, will you?"
Arietti heaved the book off her knees and stood it upright on the floor. They kept the fuel, assorted slack and crumbled candle grease, in a pewter mustard pot and shoveled it out with a spoon. Arietti trickled out a few grains, tilting the mustard spoon not to spoil the blaze. Then she stood there basking in the warmth. It was a charming fireplace, made by Arietti's grandfather with a cog wheel. The spokes of the cog wheel stood out in starry rays, and the fire itself nestled in the centre. Above there was a chimney piece made from a small brass funnel inverted. An arrangement of pipes from the spout of the funnel carried the fumes into the kitchen flues above. The fire was laid with matchsticks, and as it burnt up, the iron would become hot, and Homily would simmer soup on the spokes in a silver thimble, and Arietti would broil nuts. How cosy those winter evenings could be. Arietti, her great book on her knees, sometimes reading aloud. Pod, at his last, he was a shoemaker and made button boots out of kid gloves for his family. And Homily, quiet with her knitting. Homily knitted their jerseys on pins. A great reel of silk or cotton would stand beside her chair, and sometimes, if she pulled too sharply, the reel would tip up and roll away out of the open door, and Arietti would be sent after it, to rewind it carefully as she rolled it back. The floor of the sitting room was carpeted with deep red blotting paper, which was warm and cosy, and soaked up the spills. Homily would renew it at intervals when it became available upstairs. Homily liked things which saved washing, because drying was difficult under the floor. Water they had in plenty, hot and cold, thanks to Pod's father, who had tapped the pipes from the kitchen boiler. They bathed in a small tureen, which once had held pâté de foie gras. "What are you doing now, Arietti?" called Homily from the kitchen. "Still writing my diary." Once again, Arietti took hold of the book and heaved it back on her knees. She licked the lead of her great pencil and stared a moment, deep in thought. She allowed herself one little line on each page, because she would never, of this she was sure, have another diary. And if she could get 20 lines on each page, the diary would last her 20 years. She had kept it for nearly 2 years already, and today, March the 22nd, she read last year's entry. Mother Cross. She thought a while longer, then at last she put ditto marks under Mother and Worried under Cross. "What did you say you were doing, Arietti?" came Homily from the kitchen. Arietti closed the book. "Nothing." "Then chop me up this onion, there's a good girl. Your father's late tonight." Sighing, Arietti put away her diary and went into the kitchen. She took the onion ring from Homily and slung it lightly round her shoulders while she foraged for a piece of razor blade. "Oh, really, Arietti," exclaimed Homily. "Not on your clean jersey." Arietti stepped through the onion ring as though it were a child's hoop and began to chop it into segments. "Your father's late," muttered Homily again. "Oh, dear. Oh, dear, I wish I hadn't." "Hadn't what?" asked Arietti, her eyes watering. She sniffed loudly and longed to rub her nose on her sleeve. Homily pushed back a thin lock of hair. She stared at Arietti absently. "It's that teacup you broke." "But that was days ago," began Arietti. "I know, I know. It's not you, it's me. It's what I said to your father." "What did you say to him?" "Well, I just said, 'There's the rest of the service,' I said. Up there in the corner cupboard in the schoolroom." "I don't see anything bad in that," said Arietti, as one by one she dropped the pieces of onion into the soup. "But it's a high cupboard," exclaimed Homily. "You have to get up by the curtain. And your father at his age..." She sat down suddenly on a metal-topped champagne cork. "Oh, Arietti, I wish I'd never mentioned it." "Don't worry," said Arietti. "Papa knows what he can do." She pulled a rubber scent bottle cork out of the hole in the hot water pipe and let a trickle of scalding drops fall into the tin lid of an aspirin bottle. She added cold and began to wash her hands. "Maybe," said Homily. "But I went on about it so. What's a teacup? Your Uncle Hendreary never drank a thing that wasn't out of a common acorn cup. My mother's family never had nothing but a little bone thimble which they shared around. But it's once you've had a teacup, if you see what I mean." "Yes," said Arietti. "It's that curtain," cried Homily. "He can't climb a curtain at his age, not by the bobbles." "With his pin he could," said Arietti. "His pin? I led him into that one too. 'Take a hatpin,' I told him, 'and tie a bit of name tape to the head and pull yourself upstairs.' It was to borrow the emerald watch from her bedroom for me to time the cooking." Homily's voice began to tremble. "Your mother's a wicked woman, Arietti. Wicked and selfish, that's what she is." "You know what?" exclaimed Arietti. Homily brushed away a tear.
No, she said wanly.
What?
I could climb a curtain.
Homily rose up.
Arietti, you dare stand there in cold blood and say a thing like that?
But I could. I could borrow. I know I could.
Oh, gasped Homily. How could you speak so?
And she crumpled up again on the cork stool.
So it's come to this.
Now, Mother, please, begged Arietti. Now, don't take on.
But don't you see, Arietti, gasped Homily,
and she raised a haggard face.
My poor child, don't speak like that of borrowing. You don't know,
she dropped her voice to a fearful whisper,
what it's like upstairs.
Arietti was silent.
What is it like?
She asked after a moment. Homily wiped her face on her apron.
Your Uncle Hendreary, she began. Eglantina's father.
And then she paused.
Listen,
she said.
What's that?
Echoing on the wood was a faint vibration, the sound of a distant click.
Your father! Exclaimed Homily. Oh, look at me! Where's the comb?
They had a comb, a little silver 18th-century eyebrow comb from the cabinet in the drawing-room upstairs. Homily ran it through her hair and rinsed her poor red eyes, and when Pod came in, she was smiling and smoothing down her apron. Pod came in slowly, his sack on his back. He leaned his hatpin with its dangling name-tape against the wall, and on the middle of the kitchen table, he placed a doll's teacup.
Why, Pod,
began Homily.
Got a saucer too, he said.
He swung down the sack and untied the neck.
Here you are,
he said, drawing out the saucer. He had a round, currant bunny sort of face. Tonight it looked flabby.
Oh, Pod, said Homily, are you all right?
Pod sat down.
I'm fair enough.
You went up the curtain, said Homily. Oh, Pod, you shouldn't have. It's shaken you.
Pod made a strange face. His eyes swiveled round towards Arietti. Homily stared at him, her mouth open, and then she turned.
Come along, Arietti. You pop off to bed now like a good girl, and I'll bring you some supper.
Oh, said Arietti. Can't I see the rest of the borrowings?
Your father's got nothing now. Only food. Off you pop to bed. You've seen the cup and saucer.
Arietti went into the sitting room to put away her diary, and took some time fixing her candle on the upturned drawing pin which served as a holder.
Whatever are you doing? Grumbled Homily. Now off to bed and fold your clothes, mind.
Good night, Papa, said Arietti, kissing his flat white cheek.
Careful of the light,
he said mechanically, and watched her with his round eyes until she had closed the door.
Now, Pod, said Homily when they were alone,
tell me.
What's the matter?
Pod looked at her blankly. I've been seen, he said.
Homily put out a groping hand for the edge of the table and lowered herself slowly onto the stool.
Oh, Pod, she said.
There was a silence between them. Pod stared at Homily, and Homily stared at the table. After a while, she raised her white face.
Badly?
She asked. Pod moved restlessly.
I don't know about badly. We've been seen. Ain't that bad enough?
No one, said Homily, hasn't been seen since Uncle Hendreary, and he was the first for 45 years.
A thought struck her.
It's no good, Pod. I won't emigrate.
No one's asked you to, said Pod.
To go and live like Hendreary and Luppy in a badger's set, the other side of the world, that's where they say it is, all among the earthworms.
It's 2 fields away above the spinney, said Pod.
Nuts! That's what they eat. And berries. I wouldn't wonder if they don't eat mice.
You've eaten mice yourself,
Pod reminded her. All drafts and fresh air and the children growing up wild. Think of Arietti, said Homily. Think of the way she's been brought up. An only child, she'd catch her death. It's different for Hendreary.
Why? Asked Pod. He's got five.
That's why, explained Homily. When you've got five, they're brought up rough. But never mind that now. Who saw you?
A boy, said Pod.
A what? Exclaimed Homily.
A boy.
Pod sketched out a rough shape in the air with his hands.
You know, a boy.
But there isn't, I mean, what sort of boy?
I don't know what you mean, what sort of boy. A boy in a nightshirt, a boy. You know what a boy is, don't you?
Yes, said Homily, I know what a boy is. But there hasn't been a boy, not in this house, these 20 years.
Well, said Pod, there's one here now.
Homily stared at him in silence. Where did he see you? She asked at last.
In the schoolroom.
Oh, said Homily. When you was getting the cup?
Yes, said Pod.
Haven't you got eyes? Asked Homily. Couldn't you have looked first?
There's never nobody in the schoolroom. And what's more, he went on, there wasn't today.
Then where was he?
In bed. In the night nursery. Sitting up in bed with the doors open.
Well, you could have looked in the nursery.
How could I? Halfway up the curtain.
Is that where you was?
Yes.
With the cup?
Yes. I couldn't get up or down.
Oh, Pod, wailed Homily. I should never have let you go, not at your age.
Now look here, said Pod. I got up all right, got up like a bird, bubbles or no bubbles.
But afterwards, with the cup in the hand, if you see what I mean, a bit of cheese off a shelf or an apple, well, I drop that, and I climbs down in me own time and picks it up.
But with a cup,
you see what I mean? And coming down, you got to watch your feet. And some of the bubbles was missing. You didn't know what you could hold on to, not safely. Oh, Pod, said Homily, her eyes full of tears. What did you do?
Well, said Pod, he took the cup.
What do you mean? Exclaimed Homily aghast. Pod avoided her eyes.
Well, he'd been sitting up in bed there watching me. I'd been on that curtain a good 10 minutes.
But how do you mean he took the cup?
Well, he got out of bed and there he was standing looking up. I'll take the cup, he said.
Oh, gasped Homily. And you gave it to him?
He took it, said Pod, ever so gentle. And then, when I was down, he give it to me.
Homily put her face in her hands.
Now don't take on, said Pod uneasily.
He might have caught you, shuddered Homily.
Yes, said Pod, but he just give me the cup.
Here you are, he said. Homily raised her face. What are we going to do? Pod sighed.
Well, there isn't nothing we can do. Except...
Oh, no, exclaimed Homily. Not that, not emigrate, not that, Pod. Now I got the house so nice and a clock and all.
We could take the clock, said Pod.
And Arietti? What about her? She's not like those cousins. She can read, Pod.
He don't know where we live, said Pod.
But they look, exclaimed Homily. Remember Hendreary? They got the cat and...
No, no, said Pod. Don't bring up the past.
But you've got to think of it. They got the cat and...
Yes, said Pod. But Eglantina was different.
How different? She was Arietti's age.
Well, they hadn't told her, you see. They tried to make her believe that there was nothing but was under the floor. They never told her about Mrs. Driver or Crampfer, least of all about cats.
There wasn't any cat, Homily pointed out, not till Hendreary was seen.
Well, there was then, said Pod. You got to tell them, that's what I say, or they try to find out for themselves.
Pod, said Homily solemnly, we haven't told Arietti.
Oh, she knows, Pod moved uncomfortably. She's got her grating.
She doesn't know about Eglantina. She doesn't know about being seen.
Well, said Pod, we'll tell her. There's no hurry.
Homily stood up.
Pod, she said, we're going to tell her tonight.
Arietti had not been asleep. She had been lying under her knotted coverlet, staring at the ceiling. It was an interesting ceiling. Pod had built Arietti's bedroom out of two cigar boxes, and on the ceiling, lovely painted ladies dressed in swirls of chiffon blew long trumpets against a background of blue sky. Below, there were feathery palm trees and small white houses set about a square. It was a glamorous scene, above all by candlelight. But tonight, Arietti had stared without seeing. The wood of a cigar box is thin, and Arietti, lying straight and still, heard the rise and fall of worried voices. She had heard her own name, and she had heard the heartfelt cry of, "What shall we do?" So when Homily appeared beside her bed, she wrapped herself obediently in her quilt and joined her parents in the warmth of the kitchen. Crouched on her little stool, she sat clasping her knees, shivering a little, and looking from one face to another. Homily placed an arm round Arietti's skinny shoulders. Arietti, she said gravely. You know about upstairs?
What about it? Asked Arietti.
You know about the two giants?
Yes, said Arietti. Great Aunt Sophie and Mrs. Driver. Homily laid a roughened hand on Arietti's clasped ones.
You know about Uncle Hendreary?
Arietti thought for a while. He went abroad?
Emigrated, corrected Homily, to the other side of the world, with Aunt Luppy and all the children, to a badger's set under a hawthorn hedge.
Now, why do you think he did this?
Oh, said Arietti, her face alight, to be out of doors, to lie in the sun, to run in the grass, to swing on twigs like the birds do, to suck honey.
Nonsense, Arietti, exclaimed Homily sharply, a nasty habit.
Uncle Hendreary emigrated, she went on, stressing the word, because he was seen.
Oh, said Arietti. He was seen on the 23rd of April, 1892, by Rosa Pickhatchett on the drawing-room mantelpiece. Of all places, she added in a wondering aside.
Oh, said Arietti.
I never heard, nor no one has never seen fit, to tell why he went on the drawing-room mantelpiece in the first place.
They said it was a liver pill, put in Pod.
How do you mean? Asked Homily, startled.
A liver pill, for Luppy,
Pod spoke wearily.
Oh, said Homily. I never heard that. All the same, it was stupid and foolhardy. There's no way down except by the bell pull.
She dusted him, they say, with a feather duster, and he stood so still alongside a cupid that she might never have noticed him if he hadn't sneezed. We heard her screeching right here under the kitchen, and they never could get her to clean anything much after that that wasn't chairs or tables, least of all the tiger skin rug.
I don't hardly never bother with the drawing-room, said Pod.
Everything's got its place, like, and they see what goes. I can tell you by heart every blessed thing that's in that drawing-room, working round from the cabinet by the window to the—
"There's a mint of things in that cabinet," interrupted Homily. "Solid silver, some of them. A solid silver violin they got there, strings and all. Just right for our Arietti."
"What's the good," asked Pod, "of things behind glass?"
"Couldn't you break it?" suggested Arietti. "Just a corner, just a little tap, just a..." Her voice faltered as she saw the shocked amazement on her father's face. "Listen here, Arietti," began Homily angrily, and then she controlled herself and patted Arietti's clasped hands. "Borrowing's a skilled job, an art, like. Of all the families who've been in this house, there's only us left, and do you know for why? Because your father, Arietti, is the best borrower that's been known in these parts since, well, before your granddad's time. I've seen your father walk the length of a laid dinner table after the gong was rung, taking a nut or sweet from every dish and down by a fold in the tablecloth as the first people came in at the door. He'd do it just for fun, wouldn't you, Pod?" Pod smiled wanly.
"There weren't no sense in it."
"Maybe," said Homily, "but you did it. Who else would dare?"
"I were younger then," said Pod.
He sighed and turned to Arietti.
"You don't break things, lass. That's not borrowing."
"We were rich then," said Homily. "Oh, we did have some lovely things. We had a whole suite of walnut furniture out of the doll's house, and a set of wine glasses in green glass, and a musical snuff box, and the cousins would come and we'd have parties. Not only the cousins, the harpsichords came, everybody came, except those overmantels from the morning room. And we'd dance and dance, and the young people would sit out by the grating. 3 tunes that snuff box played. Clementine, God Save the Queen, and the Postchaise Gallop. We were the envy of everybody, even the overmantels." "Who were the overmantels?" asked Arietti. "Oh, you must have heard me talk of the overmantels," exclaimed Homily. "That stuck-up lot who lived in the wall, high up, among the lath and plaster behind the mantelpiece in the morning room. And a queer lot they were. The men smoked all the time, because the tobacco jars were kept there. And they'd climb about and in and out of the carvings of the overmantel, sliding down pillars and showing off. The women were a conceited lot, too, always admiring themselves in all those bits of overmantel-looking glass. They never asked anyone up there, and I, for one, never wanted to go. And your father never liked the men. Not only the tobacco jars, but the whiskey decanters, too, were kept in the morning room. And they say those overmantel men would suck up the dregs in the glasses through those quill-pipe cleaners. I don't know whether it's true, but they do say those overmantel men used to have a party every Tuesday after the bailiff had been to talk business in the morning room. Laid out they'd be, dead drunk, on the green plush tablecloth all among the tin boxes and the count books.
Now, Homily, protested Pod, who did not like gossip. I never seed 'em.
But you wouldn't put it past them, Pod. You said yourself when I married you not to call on the overmantels.
Well, they lived so high, said Pod. That's all.
Well, they never had no kind of a home life. Ate nothing but breakfast food. Breakfast, of course, was the only meal served in the morning room.
What happened to them? Asked Arietti.
Well, when the master died and she took to her bed, there was no use for the morning room. So the overmantels had to go. No food, no fire. It's a bitter cold room in winter.
And the harpsichords? Asked Arietti.
Homily looked thoughtful. Well, they were different. I'm not saying they weren't stuck up too, because they were. Your Aunt Luppy was a harpsichord by marriage, and we all know the airs she gave herself.
Now, Homily, began Pod.
Well, she'd no right to. She was only a rainpipe from the stables before she married Harpsichord.
Didn't she marry Uncle Hendreary? Asked Arietti.
Yes, later. She was a widow with 2 children, and he was a widower with 3. It's no good looking at me like that, Pod. You can't deny she took it out of poor Hendreary. She thought it was a come-down to marry a clock.
Why?
Asked Arietti. Because we clocks live under the kitchen, because we don't talk fancy grammar and eat anchovy toast. But to live under the kitchen doesn't mean we aren't educated. You remember that, Arietti. Your grandfather could count and write down the numbers up to... What was it, Pod?
57, said Pod.
There, said Homily. 57! And your father, Arietti, he can count and write down the numbers on and on as far as it goes. How far does it go, Pod?
Close on 1,000, said Pod.
There, exclaimed Homily. And he knows the alphabet? And he would have been able to read, wouldn't you, Pod, if he hadn't had to start borrowing so young? Your father had to go out borrowing at 13. Your age, Arietti, think of it.
But I should like... began Arietti.
So we didn't have your advantages, went on Homily breathlessly. And just because the harpsichords lived in the drawing room, they moved in there in 1837 to a hole in the wainscot just behind where the harpsichord used to stand, if there ever was one, which I doubt, and were really a family called Linen Press, and changed it to harpsichord.
What did they live on?
Asked Arietti, in the drawing room.
Afternoon tea, said Homily. Nothing but afternoon tea. No wonder the children grew up peaky. Of course, in the old days it was better, muffins and crumpets and such, and good rich cake and jams and jellies. And there was one old harpsichord who could remember syllabub of an evening. But they had to do their borrowing in such a rush, poor things. On wet days, when the human beings sat all afternoon in the drawing room, the tea would be brought in and taken away without a chance of the harpsichords getting near it. And on fine days, it might be taken out into the garden. Luppy has told me that sometimes there were days and days when they lived on crumbs. So you can't be too hard on them. Their only comfort, poor things, was to show off a bit and talk like ladies and gentlemen. Did you ever hear your Aunt Luppy talk?
Yes, no, can't remember.
Oh, you should have heard her say parquet. That's the stuff the drawing room floor is made of, parquet. Parquet, she'd say. Come to think of it, your Aunt Luppy was the most stuck-up of them all.
Arietti's shivering, said Pod. We didn't get the little maid up to talk about Aunt Luppy.
Nor did we, cried Homily, suddenly contrite. You should have stopped me, Pod. There, my lamb, tuck this quilt right round you, and I'll get you a nice drop of piping hot soup.
And yet, said Pod, as Homily, fussing at the stove, ladled soup into a teacup, we did, in a way.
Did what? Asked Homily.
Get her up to talk about Aunt Luppy. Aunt Luppy, Uncle Hendreary, and... He paused. Eggletina.
Your mother and I got you up, said Pod, to tell you about upstairs.
Arietti, holding the great cup in both hands, looked at him over the edge.
Pod coughed. You said a while back that the sky was dark brown with cracks in it. Well, it isn't.
He looked at her almost accusingly.
It's blue.
I know, said Arietti.